didn't tell the first service this story, but it's a little bit of a miracle I'm here with you this morning. Last night, so context, our daughter and son-in-law and grandkids are in our basement suite where they build a new house. So, and they have a dog, and so there's more nighttime activity. You know, we're getting old, so when it gets dark, we lock the doors. No, I'm just kidding. It's maybe not quite there, but we're headed that direction. So they're outside. So they told us a while ago that they had seen a rat. Now, that was troubling. That was a somewhat disturbing moment. But anyway, last night we get a text. All sorts of rats out in the hedge. I'm like, oh my goodness. So I go out armed with a LED light and my pellet gun. So like, I'm not going to take this lying down. So you can now picture me in the dark with my light in a cedar hedge. And I can hear them. They are there. I'm like, oh my goodness. But I can't see them. And as soon as the light goes on, everything goes silent. Light goes away, scurry, scurry, scurry. I'm like, oh my goodness. And I'm trying with a scope and it's dark. So finally I decide I'm just gonna put the light down, aim it into the tree. When I see movement, I will shoot. Now I waited there for probably a minute and no movement. At that point, I'm now impatient and it's like, I'm done with the great rat hunt of 2025. I'm going inside, but I have a pellet in the gun. So I'm like, I feel like I probably should just shoot that into the hedge. It helps you understand my mind, my mental space. It's like, that's just the kind of thing I would do all the time. So I shoot into the hedge and the rat jumps out of the hedge. It has wings and it flies towards me. Now, it takes my head and my heart a few minutes to process that it's actually a quail, that my hedge is not infested with rats, it's a quail scurrying around. Anyway, I recovered and I'm here and I'm delighted to be here with you. And to report that my hedge is not full of rats, it's full of quails, and I won't go and shoot them. Anyway, it's been an interesting 24 hours. But we're in Zechariah chapter 10. Has nothing to do with any of that. What it does have to do is with a group of people who God has returned to their land, the promised land, who are facing hard things. And in that, we can kind of relate. Like, there's lots of the story where it's like, okay, we understand it's, you know, 2,500 years ago, and the culture and technology and all this, everything, there's so much that's different. But you have probably come across a moment in your life where you thought, I need help. I can't do this anymore. In fact, I would say the first question, and maybe the primary question that Zechariah 10 is going to ask us is, I would just put it this simply, where do you turn? When you realize, I can't do this. I don't have the ability, I don't have the skill, I don't have the strength, I don't have the things that I would need to do this. And I'm going to leave the this as vague as that. The context, the situation that's actually going on in Zechariah chapter 10 has to do with rain. You probably heard Melissa, she read that. Ask rain from the Lord. So if we were to go back, we would see that there's two prophets writing to the people of Israel at this time in history. One's name is Haggai, the other is Zechariah. We've been in Zechariah for like several months now. We're still working our way through it. Zechariah doesn't talk so much about the rain, but it's the same time in history. Haggai alerts us to the fact that there has been a drought in the land. And if you know kind of how rains work in the Middle East, it's actually pretty simple. There's kind of two periods. They call them the early rain and the later rain, or latter rain. In fact, Joel's going to pick up that language. If you ever read the prophet Joel, he picks up the language about latter rain and uses it almost like a way to describe the goodness and blessing of God that one day will come upon his people. That's a separate issue. But the early rains would have happened actually right about now, so kind of like mid-October till early November. And what it accomplished is it brought moisture to the ground so they could plow and work the fields and then put seed in the ground. Because you know, even here in the Okanagan, say by late August, you go out and try to dig a hole in your backyard and it's like digging concrete. You're not going to plant if there wasn't some sort of moisture in it. So that early rain was critical just to get the seed in the ground. Now the seed sits there. Rains generally stopped mid-November and didn't resume until some point in February, and then went from sort of early to mid-February to just the beginning of April. That was the latter rain. That was important because now the plant has started to grow, and the plant growing needs rain so that it can become a healthy plant and then put out whatever the fruit or vegetation that's going to be harvested. And then that rain would stop. It would give the plant, the grain or whatever it was typically, chance to ripen, and then it would be harvested. The people in Zechariah's day had just come through a year where the rain didn't come. Which again, for us, if you are just like a backyard gardener, you're like, that's unfortunate, it's discouraging. You know, typically we would just turn on a sprinkler. 2,500 years ago, there's no faucet, no tap, no hose, no sprinkler. Okay, so maybe we had a year where even the sprinkler didn't help. Well, then we just go to, you know, Freshco, Superstore, pick your grocery store, and you just buy what you need, and merrily we go on. 2,500 years ago, there is no grocery store or corner store. Your life and the life of your family literally depends on that little plant growing, producing something, because that's what you're going to eat. I think for us, it's one of those moments in Scripture that's just kind of hard to quite really be able to understand. The amount of pressure, like the desperation, how important it was. And so through the Old Testament, you get a number of these stories, right? Where there's no rain. You think of Elijah and then the implication of that whole piece to the story. But here in Zechariah chapter 10, the people have had no rain. We've now come into sort of a year where they're wrestling through the implications of that. And now they are faced with a problem. And I guess that's kind of how I want to describe it. Because probably for us, the problem's never going to be, do we have enough rain? I mean, maybe. We're in the Okanagan. I guess there are moments where in the fall or summer we go, oh, it sure be nice to get some rain. But it is a different level of desperation, probably. But you have probably come to moments in your life where the problem ahead of you felt as desperate as what it would have felt like for the people of Israel to have no rain. Where do you turn? Now, for Zechariah's day, the people had a couple choices. One, they could turn to God. The God who had promised, if they turned to him and called out to him, you can read it there with your own eyes. If you asked me, I would make storm clouds and I would give you rain. I would produce what you need. Or, see where verse 2 goes? For the household gods, that's actually a really interesting word. I went down this rabbit trail in the first service, so just in case you're in a small group, here's the little bonus aside lesson. The word actually is teraphim. We actually don't know what it is. Some translations say idol, some say household god. I actually had a show of hands in the first service. There was actually one person in first service whose Bible actually used the word teraphim. It first shows up, actually, I think it first shows up in Genesis, I think it's 19. I could be off by a couple chapters. The story of Jacob. He ends up marrying two women. Don't let that throw you off too much. Leah and Rachel. And if you remember the story, when they all flee from Laban, Rachel, I think it is, steals the, well, most of our translations say the household gods. She steals the teraphim. And she puts them kind of like under the saddle blanket and rides away. So you're reading the story. It's like, well, probably if she's sitting on this thing, like as I'm picturing it, it's like a little idol. That's what comes to mind. I think that's not a bad image. Except later on in David's story, his wife, Michal, is trying to help him escape a dangerous situation. And I don't know if you remember the story. It's kind of one of those great stories that if you're like a grade 5 boy, these are awesome Bible stories. He escapes, and she then puts the teraphim under the covers of his bed so that when they look in, they'll think David is sleeping in his bed. Now, if it's that, right, you have a problem. It's like, that's not fooling anyone. All that to say, it's kind of a weird word. The other place I think it shows up in an interesting way is, I think it's Ezekiel, where the king of Babylon is described of having consulted the teraphim. In other words, he's got a decision to make. He's like, I don't know what to do. He consults. Somehow, what this thing is some sort of an idol type of a thing that people are turning to for direction. I guess I could have just said that and saved you all that fun Bible trivia, but now you'll know when you're reading it what's kind of going on in that. So God says, you should ask me, you come to a problem, in this case rain, you should ask me, not these other gods, small g gods, not these idols, not these. He goes on, talks about diviners who see lies, they tell false dreams. In other words, God's saying you have options when you have a problem where you're going to turn. Don't turn to things that are going to lead you astray. It's kind of the argument. You kind of see, it's like they will give you false information. They will give you information. It's just not going to be right. The other prophets go on and say things like this. And not only will they give you wrong information, you will be changed to become like them. That terrifies me. Because we look and go, I look and go, well, I've never been once in my life tempted to put a little stick god on the mantle of my fireplace and worship it or consult it. But 1 John tells us that that's really not at the heart of the issue, is it? Idol worship is not about a little rock carving or a little stick carving. It's about putting anything in the place of God and pursuing that thing as the source of our comfort and security and direction in life. Oh, man. And I get really uncomfortable when I define it that way because I think, oh, that I'm tempted to do. Kind of like, probably not unlike Israel, where it's like, we're going to worship God. We'll have a foot in the God camp, but maybe we'll just also worship another God too. Have you ever been there? A foot in the God camp, but maybe we need the bank account. Maybe what the TSX tells me today is going to affect. Maybe it's my blood pressure. Maybe it's a relationship. Whatever it is that you look and go, that other thing is also going to be the source of my security. Here's what God is saying. I think if I'm doing the math right, that other thing will inform your life. It's just not going to do it truthfully. You will reach wrong conclusions. You'll be led in wrong directions. And you will be eventually transformed into the character of the thing that you've set your attention to. So, where do you turn? Now that's verse 1 and 2. Verse 3 to 5, I want to suggest, I'll give you the outline, how I view this chapter. Verse 1 to 2, where do you turn? Verse 3 to 5 is, turn to the good shepherd. Verse 6 to 12 is, here's how the good shepherd saves us. So that's kind of that's what I see as I look through this chapter. So verse 5, God tells us, my anger is hot against the shepherds. In other words, this is kind of the language he's using for leadership. You see it in the next little phrase. I will punish the leaders. Shepherd, leader, same thing. So if there is a, excuse me, if there is a leader or shepherd who is leading us away from God towards these other replacements of God, God says, I am not pleased. In fact, you read through the rest of the prophets, you'll see he's going to bring the severest judgment for that category of people. Then in the middle point of verse 3, a shift happens. We go from sort of those strong warnings and cautions and judgment to this. 4, the Lord of hosts cares for his flock. If you've trusted Jesus, it's actually interesting. You remember the language of John 10, if you've ever read it, where Jesus says, I want you to know who I am. I'm the good shepherd. It's like, hold on a second. You see what he's doing? He's taking this beautiful Old Testament background, all this way that we kind of understand what it ought to look like to be led well, and he picks all of it up and he says, I am the good shepherd. I'm not one of a number of, I'm it. I'm the good shepherd. And the good shepherd will lay down his life for his sheep. I'm not going to run when things get hard. I'm not going to abandon you. I will give my life for yours. So God says that he cares for his flock, the house of Judah, cares so much. Look at the next statement. I will make them like a majestic steed in battle. I'm not just going to leave my people like an aimless, weak lamb or sheep, kind of to use the imagery. I'm going to transform them. They're going to become like a majestic battle steed. I'm going to transform them. You'll see that throughout the passage, that as God saves, it's not just that he saves us for the sake of us being saved, but he saves us and transforms us and leaves us strong so that then we are sent out to serve others and to glorify God's name. But here in verse 4, we get a really interesting, through Zechariah, I haven't talked about this much. I probably should have at the beginning to forewarn you what was going to happen in the book, but now it starts to become important that we have to pay very close attention to pronouns. And I know, it's like, oh man, here we are, English lessons again. the way the prophets and Zechariah is like many of them, there's a strange fluidity to the language where he moves in and out of pronoun usage. And you have to pay really close attention because he might say he or they or I, and you have to kind of wonder, it's like, well, who is the he or who is the they or who is the I? And so you're going to watch that happen through the rest of this chapter. I'll point out a couple moments of it that I think are worth just paying attention to. But you see, he goes from speaking the Lord cares for his flock. For from him, meaning that's the Lord, right? From the Lord comes the cornerstone, and from him the tent peg, and from him the battle bow, and from him every ruler, all of them together. So coming from God seems to be the picture that Zechariah is describing for us, is that there is a singular figure coming from God who is going to be the culmination of what it means to be the shepherd, who is described in three ways: as a cornerstone, as a tent peg, and as a bow, like a bow and arrow. And then, second to that, comes also other leaders. So I'm going to argue, and if you want to have a discussion on this, shoot me off an email. I'd love to talk with you about this week. That figure number one is Jesus, the chief shepherd. In our lingo, it's funny kind of how we might translate, but that, like, the senior pastor of our church, the senior pastor of all the church, he is it. And then there are other leaders that God gives to his people to serve his people. Now, Jesus, if I got this right, is the same figure from back in chapter 9 we read about in verse 9 and 10. This humble individual that Zechariah 9 introduces to us, a king who rides on a donkey, not a characteristic animal of a king. This is not a military animal. This is an animal of peace. And we find out this king is spectacularly powerful and yet humble. And he's meek, and yet he is going to win a spectacular victory. And we're left kind of putting, he will save, but he needs to be saved, right? And as you start thinking through Jesus and the gospel, it's like, well, the lights go on. It's like that exactly describes him. Spectacularly powerful. He defeats sin and death. He does it by dying, and his father saves him in the sense of bringing to life again. It's like, the gospel in two verses in Zechariah chapter 9. But here we get another sort of description of him. He's a cornerstone. I'm not going to spend too much time on this one because we talked about this image before, even in Zechariah, that it's either, it can mean one of two things. It's a stone that either is like the central stone of the foundation of the building from which all other stones are placed. So the very first stone, you dig your hole. It's like, we're about to build a building. Let's get the first stone in the exact right place because all the other stones are going to come off of that one. Either it's that or it's the capstone, the very last stone that completes it all. And you get back and forth kind of a sense of that as you read through scripture. And it seems like the point scripture is making is he's actually both. He's it. You want a place to build your life on? Get that piece first. And you want to figure out what completes, what is the pinnacle of life? He's like, he's that too. But we're not going to spend much time on that one because it's the next one for Zechariah that's a bit new. You've probably never thought of Jesus as a tent peg. It's a funny sounding thing to us because in our lingo, you put up your tent. The tent pegs are the things at the end of the string. You hammer into the ground. You probably got maybe a dozen of them around the tent. Like, that's kind of sort of what a tent peg. Years ago, Lynn and I, when we decided we were going to go camping with the kids, they were like babies, and we went and bought a tent from Canadian Tire. I've told this story before. I set it up in the backyard as the test. Like, okay, got it. Off we go. Night number one, we were outside of Christina Lake at a little provincial campground on the side of the highway that had one of those beautiful gravel tent pads. And I broke every peg trying to pound them into that, like, concrete, like gravel. Then I returned the tent to Canadian Tire the next day, and it's like, your tent doesn't work. And we never tented again. That's the wrong image, okay? So let me get you the right picture of why would Jesus be described as a tent peg? In a tent like what is being described in Zechariah 10, there's not multiple poles and multiple pegs. There's one pole. A center pole goes up in the middle, everything hangs off of it. that's probably getting us more into kind of the right picture of what Zechariah is trying to help you understand about Jesus. He holds everything up. It all hangs on him. Now, there's one additional piece that gets this a little bit quirky, but you guys are good at figuring this stuff out. The word also is used on occasion for a nail that's put into the tent peg. So if you were to go look at Isaiah chapter 22, this is the way it's used there. So again, now imagine you've got your tent with one pole, and inside you want to put valuable things or important things somewhere. You can't go around and put nails in your tent. For some of us who don't like nails on the wall, this sounds very appealing at a certain level, right? You can't hang pictures, you can't hang stuff in a tent. So you put one pretty big nail through that pole, and everything valuable, everything important hangs on it. I think that's the sense of Isaiah chapter 22, and I actually think that's probably the sense that Zechariah has in mind. Jesus is the cornerstone. Everything is supported by him and based upon him. And he is the one upon which everything important hangs and rests and supported. Zechariah, I think even himself, I couldn't tell you the verse, talks about how he bears royal honor. So that's kind of a picture of like, he's the only one who can carry the weight of the glory of God because he is God. But it's that kind of sense of the supremacy of Jesus that Zechariah is unpacking for us. Then he moves into that last sort of description. We're not going to spend much time there about how he's not only is he the cornerstone and he's this tent peg, but even in addition to that, he's the battle bow. In other words, he is powerful. And I just quick aside here as we get into the next part of Zechariah, for those who are new to prophetic descriptions, we don't believe that what we're being called to is some sort of military campaign. I just want to say it, because when you read some of this, it starts, you know, talks about the leaders in verse 5. They're going to like trample their foes in the muds of the streets. We believe what Paul says to us in Ephesians 6, that our battle is not against flesh and blood. There's no call on the people of God to somehow take up arms and to go fight an enemy. Not physically. Our call is to engage in a spiritual battle. And we engage in a spiritual battle, according to Philippians 2, the way I read it, by laying down our lives and serving. And even if it meant to the point of laying down our lives to the point of sacrificing them for the cause of Christ, that's our calling, but not some sort of warfare. But this is sort of language, this is imagery that would have made a lot of sense to these people. And so Jesus is now portrayed as the battle bow. He will win. And do I believe that? Oh yeah, he did. When he died on the cross, he won. Verse 5. Now we transition into this idea of every ruler. In other words, Jesus is the chief shepherd. He's the senior pastor. And God gifts his church with others who lead. We have an amazing group of leaders in our church. Through all sorts of ministries, all sorts of different capacities. I actually got to spend yesterday the whole day with our elders. And every time I sit around the table with them, it's like I am so incredibly thankful that God has given us a group of godly men who love you. You might not even know who they all are. We're actually trying to, it's actually one of the conversations, like probably you should know who they are, both to pray for them and to be able to look to them and say, that's kind of who we should follow after. It's part of their job is to model godly, Christ-like living. But to hear them, how they speak of their concern to care for you well as a church, to lead with wisdom and stability and just godliness is an astounding thing. God has blessed us. And I think that's what that verse 5 is about. They're like mighty men in battle, trampling the foe in the mud of the streets. Not literally, but man, they are there for you. Now, how? Now, here's where I want to transition from, okay, where do we turn to, here's, we could turn to the Good Shepherd. Then what takes place next? So I'm going to give you my way of thinking of this, and it might not be your way of thinking of this, but this might just encourage you. It might at least cause you to think on some of these things. So we're told at the end of that verse in verse 5, they will fight because the Lord is with them. And then when you get all the way to the end of the chapter, verse 12, I'm just going to skip ahead. I will make them strong in the Lord and they will walk in his name, declares the Lord. You see the change from verse 2 to 12? In verse 2, we are wandering like sheep, like aimlessly wandering around. By verse 12, we are walking in the Lord with strength. Something happens in between those two things. And I would argue we are saved. That's what's taking place between those two things. Now, we'll look at that part in just a second. But before we do, I want to just talk with you for a minute about this idea of how it is we are made strong in the Lord. It's actually a really, it is not a platitude. Okay, if you go back to, I should have double checked this between services. I'm pretty sure it's 1 Samuel chapter 26. David, if you remember David, he's in a tough spot. And he has a good friend, his name is Jonathan. Actually, I'm going to preach on him in the new year, actually, because he's a fascinating character. Have you ever wondered, why didn't Jonathan go and fight Goliath? Like, Jonathan appears to have complete confidence in God. Nowhere in the story does it ever seem like he doubts, but it's almost like Jonathan steps back, but he's going to let someone else who God has appointed step forward. I could be wrong on that, but I wonder. But Jonathan comes in 1 Samuel chapter 26, and all we read is, he strengthens David in the Lord. Like, what is that? It's the same phrase we read here, that we are, in verse 12, made strong in the Lord. A few chapters later, 1 Samuel 30, Jonathan's not there, and David strengthens himself in the Lord. It's almost like whatever Jonathan taught him, and however Jonathan helped him see and understand something, David is able to kind of take on from that point on his own. I'll give you an example of how I have endeavored to do this in my own life that I think fits a little bit with what's going on in Zechariah. I'll give you the image, okay? So here's me. In front of me is the problem. I've had a few over the course of life. I'm sure I will have more. And on my own, when I look at the problem, I often think I don't know how to go. I don't know how to get through it, around it, over it. It seems daunting. Have you ever had one of those problems? You're like, I just don't know. I'm stuck. I think to strengthen ourselves in the Lord is to essentially put what we know about God between us and the problem. The problem is still there. Now we've just added a new element, a belief in God. So for me, my go-to place is Isaiah 41, verse 10. Fear not, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. It's just one verse. So I take what I know to be true about God. I put that right there. And then I start to think of the situation through a different set of lens. Now, Isaiah 41 actually tells us four things about God in the verses leading up to verse 10. It tells me first that God is the judge of all the world. He's in control. Second thing it tells me is that he actually rules the rulers. So the first is like verse 1, 2, then it's verse like 3, 4. He rules all the rulers. All of them are subservient to him. The third thing, is actually probably the most hard to articulate, because I think what Isaiah is wanting us to see is not just that God is eternal, and it's more than God just creates everything. I believe both those things, but I don't think that's the point Isaiah is trying to make. I think he's trying to say something more like, everything that exists is temporal and comes from him. He is the source. And so, yes, he's creator. Yes, he's eternal. But it's more like the focus is on what he has created, that it's all temporal, temporary. And it all is created and designed and fashioned by him. The fourth thing he tells us in Isaiah chapter 41 is that his people are chosen by him. He loves them and he calls them and he cares for them. Okay, so then I go, okay, I know some things about God. I know he's in control. He's the judge of all the world. And there's no ruler that he is not over. And he's made everything. And he's called me my name. And I can say I, because if you read Isaiah 41, it's not he, it's not third person language. It's God speaking to us and saying, fear not, for I, right? I am with you. And I will strengthen you. And I will help you, and I will uphold you. My heart gets strengthened. Between me and the problem is a God who is controlling all things. And he's called me and he loves me. Now, I mention all that because when I think of that, those truths of God, and I think of what Zechariah has told us, it's actually remarkably similar. Has Zechariah been anxious to tell us that God is the judge of all things? Yes, he has. And that God rules all the rulers? Yes, he has. And that God is eternal and he is the creator? Yes, he has. And that God has called us? He's actually about to do that in the very next couple of verses here, where he talks about whistling. It's a really strange thing in verse 8. We have to bear in mind that he's still using the imagery of a sheep and shepherd, right? So he's like, he knows the whistle to call his sheep to himself. I will call them. I will draw them to myself. It's all those same truths. And then you see in verse 5, what does he tell the leaders? And it's not just leaders. Isaiah 41 is not just for the leaders who are called. It's for the people of God. The Lord is with you. Remember how verse 10 goes? Fear not, for I am with you. Now, I hope you will think through your own way of how it is that you need to strengthen your heart because of what you know to be true about God. There are countless passages in Scripture that will do the same thing. Just taking what we know to be true, remembering those things so that we are strengthened. And as verse 12 says, God is going to make us strong. It's his promises. It's not a command. It's not saying you have to go away and do this. It's just like, I'm going to do this because I'm going to reveal who I am. And that's how it works for me. It's like he's revealed who he is. This is not me now mustering the effort and energy to go out and strengthen. It's just like, this is just me remembering what God has told me to be true. My heart strengthened. Now, okay, sorry, that was a little bit of an aside, but it just was an important moment in Zechariah to talk about that for a little bit because of the language. It's all right there. I want to talk to you next about verse 6 to 12, and I would kind of consider it under this heading. So where do we turn? We turn to the Good Shepherd. How does he save? So verse 6 to 12, we almost get like a brief synopsis of how God always saves his people. I get it. At this point of history, we're reading place names and things, and we're probably curious of like who this is and what's all going on. There are lots of speculations of what point of history that maybe Zechariah is specifically addressing. I'm not going to go into that too far because I think it applies for all God's saving work. It doesn't change. This is just the nature of God's saving work. So the first piece is this, that salvation has a basis. I don't know how else to put it. That's a bad way to put it. If I had a third service, I'd probably try to get that one different, but we don't. There's a basis to salvation. The basis is God. There's kind of what I want to. It's not us. It's not that we are somehow earning or meriting where God looks upon Don or Eve and is like, huh, there's some good material to work with. I'm going to choose him. Not that at all. In fact, it's pretty much the opposite. It's when we realize that we don't bring anything to the table. And I would make that claim based on the language from verse 6 to 12. If you're into underlining things in your Bible, sometimes just go through those verses and underline every time God says, I will. I will strengthen. I will bring them. I will whistle for them. I will bring them home. Like it's all God's work. I think there's six of them. All God's work. Never once does it, I will do this because of them. It's just, I will do this. The basis of our salvation always has been, always will be, God's work. In the New Testament, you go read Ephesians 2, and Paul's just like, I just want you to understand. It's by grace you've been saved. It's not by works. That's the same idea. The basis of our salvation is God's work. The second thing, salvation happens through the calling of God. Now again, verse 8 is maybe not as clear as we will be able to come to see it in the New Testament, but you just get that moment in verse 8. I'll whistle and they'll come. I like how Jesus says it in John 10. My sheep know my voice. I will call them. My sheep know my voice. When they hear my voice, they will answer. We had a pretty awesome story unfold. We have so many awesome stories, actually. It's just many of you are sitting in the seats and we don't like telling your story. You're like, hold on a second. I'm not sure I want to be talked about on a Sunday morning. This one's safe because we had a situation where there was a young gal traveling. I'm not going to give you her name. We'll kind of spare that part. She was traveling through Vernon on a year-long round-the-world adventure. I think she's in her 20s. She went to an event here in Vernon just over a week ago. think it was like a wellness fair or something like that, which is not, I don't think known to be like a hub of Christian goodness. I think it's probably more like a hub of alternative type of things. So when she went, someone, I don't know exactly what they said. That's actually, I would love to be able to ask the people who were there what they actually said to this young gal. What she heard was, "Would you like a reading?" She thought, palm reading. Did not expect them to read scripture and present the gospel. So they did. She Googled church. I think maybe someone said, "You should go to church." Ended up connected with Emmanuel for all of 4 days. Women's Bible study, some of you were there, you cared for her. It made a huge impact. She showed up last Sunday in church. We had someone in our church walk her through everything that was going on in service, like, because she'd never been in church before. Okay, now we're going to stand. I mean, communion. We did communion last Sunday. Can you imagine walking into church your very first time? Like, what on earth is happening? We knew the next day she was leaving town, and so we started to pray. It's like, what do you do with someone who is brand new to this? No background, no context. I don't think I doubted, I worried. I wondered, like, what's going to happen in this story? Found out a couple days later, the next part. I have no idea what God's going to do in the days to come. She gets to Kelowna on a plane to go to Vancouver. Sits next to a fellow on the plane. Looks at him and says, "Were you at Emmanuel yesterday?" To which he says, "Yes." We don't know who he was. He was visiting one of you. He was here one Sunday. Gets to Vancouver. Now her plan is to travel the world and then she's going to settle in Victoria. I don't know why Victoria. Victoria's a pretty enough place, but that's the plan. Settle in Victoria. Gets to the hostel in Vancouver. I don't know a lot about hostels. I've not really, it's not my thing. I don't ever imagine, the picture of a hostel in my mind is not like everyone's gathering around talking about Jesus. I could be wrong. Apparently I was wrong about what happened in a hostel on Monday, because when she went to the hostel, she saw a gal and she thought, "I wonder if she's a Christian," and said, "Are you a Christian?" And the gal pulled her Bible out of her backpack and said, "Yes, I am." And they got talking. And it turns out they're both traveling the world, doing some grand adventure. And at the end of the grand adventure, they're both going to Victoria. And the second gal, who is a Christian, has walked with Jesus for a while, said, "When you get to Victoria, here's my number. Text me, because then we can go to church together. My sheep hear my voice, and they know it, and they follow." And sometimes it's spectacular moments like that where you just go, like, how on earth is Jesus going to save that sheep, like that one that he has called and chosen, that he would do it like that is mind-boggling. And then sometimes it's a little child who grows up in your home, who faithfully over years gets to hear stories about Jesus, and Jesus calls them too. Jesus can call his sheep and they will hear his voice and they will follow. And that is the how of saving. Some of you I know here this morning where you're just like, hold on a second, we're just checking out church. We're not in. We're just kind of figuring out what this is all about. I actually believe that is part of Jesus speaking to you. And I'm so glad you're here, because Jesus loves you. He actually gave himself so that you could be forgiven. And as this passage talks, like there's one more, it's a rabbit trail. I said I wasn't going to go there in first service, and I did, but I have to here as well, because it just, to me, is just too precious to skip over. Verse 6. And we'll get to the first part of the compassion in a second, but just notice the last, the middle clause. "They shall be as though I had not rejected them." That's a really interesting statement. That's speaking of Israel. Israel had rebelled against God, and they had faced some pretty tough consequences. They'd gone into exile. There had been some, we would use probably language of like some pretty significant trauma those people went through. But to hear the promise, my forgiveness is going to be so spectacular that I'm actually going to rewrite their history. It will be like that never happened. I think that's true for any of us when we receive the gift of forgiveness through Jesus. It's not just like he just forgives and then kind of, okay, now we're going to move on. It's like he forgives and it's like everything behind us, it's all rewritten. And the grace of God just has its stamps all over our story from that point on. So basis of salvation, the call of salvation, the third part is just the motive. Real quick, verse 6, the motive again is not us. I will bring them back. Why? This is the middle part of verse 6, because I have compassion. It's rooted in God, which is so liberating because you don't ever have to think, well, hold on a second. If people ever really knew the real me, they'd have a different impression. If God ever knew the real me, what might he think? He does know the real you. You're not saved. You're not called because he looks and says, you've earned it or merited it. It's just because he has compassion. In fact, when you go later into the chapter, verse 10 and 11, it starts to get into Exodus language. And for this, we definitely don't have time. But the language of Exodus, again, is that just that language of God's just great, sovereign, redeeming call over a people. He picked them not because they had any merit. In fact, he picked them because of the exact opposite. I'm going to pick the weak and the little and the frail so that when I pick them and work through them, no one's going to be confused. Everyone's going to know this was my doing. That's, I think, why the language of Exodus in verse 10 and 11. Lastly, the fruit of salvation. God doesn't just save us just to kind of put us on a trophy shelf and go, now you just sit over there and I'll go out and do. He saves us and transforms us. And that's through the rest of the chapter as you read, say, verse 9, that they remember me and they live and return. And there's this sense of action of God's transforming work in the lives of his people so that by the end of it, they've been made strong in the Lord and they will walk in his name. You've been saved so that God can now send you out. That's terrifying and awesome. That no matter how long you've walked with Jesus, he has a plan for you. Again, back to Ephesians 2, it's kind of how this whole thing ends, right? God has prepared things in advance, specifically with you in mind, that his purposes and his plans are going to be carried out as he transforms you, makes you strong in the Lord so that you're able to save him. And with that, we've run out of time, but let me pray for you and we're done.